always believed that everyone has a story and that everyone's story has value. I'm Joanna Pena Bickley, the host of Designed By, a new Designed By Us documentary series that recognizes the changemakers, imagineers, and inventors in esteemed science, technology, engineering, arts, math, and design. As I have traveled the globe and collaborated with some of the world's leading scientists, artists, and mathematicians, I know that daring to design the future today all begins with a vision and a narrative of a hopeful future. I invite you to join us on a journey of discovery, finding the voices and magic makers changing the very shape of our future. I couldn't be more excited to introduce you to Timothy Bardelevens. Timothy and I had an opportunity to meet. I was like, there was serendipity to that evening. But as you know, we are a studio production that is dedicated to illuminating the stories of audacious designers and creators and makers who are having an impact on the world. And Timothy is absolutely one of those people. So Timothy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You know, I always love to really try to understand where people came from. What's your origin story? And so let's start there.
Yeah. I'll try to give the truncated version of this. So usually I start with, like, I'm a gay Black man from the South. And usually I connect it with, who'd have thunk that a gay Black man in the South would end up in the Pacific Northwest? So I'm from the Carolinas, both North and South. I spent time in both. I never knew about design until my junior year of college, when I decided to make the transition from English to design. But if I look at my life growing up as a kid, like, I remember when I had to write papers in kindergarten, I always want to put a border around it. Or whenever I did PowerPoint presentations, I did these random things with word art where they change colors or they flipped in some kind of way. And I was really particular about the types of fonts I use and things like that. And so I always paid attention to these small things when I was younger, but I never connected to design. It was just like, I just wanted it to be the best. I wanted it to stand out in the crowd. When I went to undergrad, I went to Coastal Carolina University in Conway, South Carolina, which most people only know Myrtle Beach, which is where they're going when they pass through Conway. My undergrad was in English, and at least for the first 3.5 years. And then I switched last minute to design. And the reason for that was really because it was a few reasons. One was I wanted to be the editor-in-chief of Jet Magazine, because I thought it was like the blackest magazine you could think of. And it was like really well-respected. And so I was like, okay, I need to learn how to do layouts and stuff. So I'll take design for that. But in the midst of that, I also was working in the Office of Student Activities and Leadership, now called, I think, the Student Union. There's these two women, two Black women, who they became like my godmother, my god aunt, and they hired me as a student worker. And, you know, they actually took a chance on me because apparently I had a reputation as someone who talked a lot, and I didn't have much of a filter, which I don't know where that came from. I'm such a quiet and humble person. Outside of my mother, like, they were the first ones who were not my parents, who said, you need to show people who you are and stop playing around, because you have gifts and, like, you need to use it. And so, like, they sort of galvanized me to dig deeper. Like, they're the ones who pushed me to, like, take design, because it was this thing I was doing all the time, and go to the director of the department and say, hey, can I get paid for this? And they were the ones who encouraged me to get paid even more money for it. And so I was one of the first student workers, probably working 40 hours a week for $10 an hour, getting paid a lot of money at that time for a student, because it was just something I became super passionate about. So this, you know, I was in the South for a bit after I graduated. Actually, I worked in a trophy company for a while, creating those participation trophies and certificates for elementary schools. I was fired there. I may have said something that was questionable about the owner of the company, so I was let go. And I left design for about 2 or 3 years or more, and I actually went into retail. I became a store manager. And it was a moment when I moved to Charlotte, and there's a woman, a Latina woman named Jennifer Pruitt. She came in. She was the senior vice president of internal communications for Bank of America. And she said something really interesting to me because we were just talking about just random things. And she just said to me, like, your 20s are the hardest time in your life because you want everything to have happened already. You feel completely behind the ball and you're still trying to find yourself at the same time. But your 30s is when life starts. This is when you start to figure things out. Is when you can, when you start to like understand what your path is, things like that. And so after that conversation, I was galvanized once again to, you know, I was like, okay, I have to do something. So I gave myself a deadline in February. I'm gonna have my portfolio done and updated, and then I'm just gonna go out. I'm just gonna do it. So I did that, and I went and started looking for jobs again. I got a contract role at this dental manufacturing company in Charlotte, in North Carolina. I was there for about a year and some change. I was flipped to full time, and it was the worst experience of my life because it was the first time I ever dealt with the passive aggression of honestly white people and especially white women. I felt for the first time what it meant to be black in corporate America in that kind of way. I learned how I had to apologize for my leadership's mistakes and how it wasn't their fault, but me misinterpreting it, or what can I do to work better? I learned that as a black man that I needed to smile more. I learned that as a gay man, I was less threatening, so I could lean on that to help move me along and like keep me safe. I learned so much about just who I was. When I left that role, I made a promise to myself that I would never be anybody than who I was ever again. I would never make those same decisions. I would never apologize for my thoughts. I would never be scared to be upset about something. And I would stop caring about people's perception of me. Because if you view me as dangerous, that's on you. It's not my fault. And so that was one of the really important moments in my life. And from there, I left that role. I cast my net wide. I was like, I can't start a career in the Carolinas. I have to go somewhere. And so I got an offer to go to Ernst & Young in DC. And I'd been writing out all these things that I really was passionate about and all the things I really wanted to do with my career. And one of the big things for me, especially coming from a lower income family, was I never want to be broke another day in my life. I want to thrive instead of just survive. And so at that moment, a week before I was supposed to move to DC, I called up the recruiter and I said, I'm sorry, but I can't come. And she just said, good luck on your career. And I thought it was the worst thing that I could have ever heard. And in that moment, I also was waiting to hear back from Capital One in Dallas for an art director role. And it'd been about 6 weeks. I had done everything from like sleep on my grandmother in my grandmother's spare room to my sister's couch. I'd asked to borrow money from friends just to pay my car note. And I finally heard back from them. They flew me down to Dallas. I interviewed a week later. They offered me the job. They told me the salary was awesome. It was the most money I'd ever made. I was making like that one job made it. So I was making more money than probably a lot of my family members combined. But there was one problem. I couldn't afford to get there. And it was the scariest part of my life because I had to call the recruiter and say, I really appreciate it, but I have no idea how I'm going to get there. And at that moment, what she did was, she's like, okay, let me go talk to the team. They came back and they actually gave me a bonus, my sign-on bonus early, and paid the taxes on it, which gave me enough money to get down to Dallas. I basically put a little hitch on the back of my Toyota Camry, and I drove from South Carolina. My mother sat on the porch crying at 2 a.m. down to Dallas. And I get choked up thinking about it. But it was the best. It was the best thing I could have ever done, because I took a leap of faith that that really it started my life and my career in a way that I never thought possible. And it was so great to work at Capital One for about 2 years. It was just awesome to have that time. And from there, let's see, I actually learned about, well, Capital One purchased an agency called Adaptive Path, and I learned about UX for the first time in my life. And at the time, I was an art director in the auto finance part of the company, and I was basically designing emails. But it was great. Like, I was working with copywriters and other designers and art directors, and so I felt like I was really moving somewhere. But I learned about this UX thing. I was like, man, this is awesome. So I went to this 5-day intensive seminar, learned all about this UX and research and everything else. So I was like, I want to do this. So I looked at the emails I was designing, and I just like created user journeys out of the emails. And I looked at this landing page I was doing. I just created these wireframes, and I just like made up a portfolio. And I looked for a job in Dallas, and I shot way too far. In a sense, I actually ended up getting a job at a startup as senior director of creative and UX. And mind you, startup titles mean absolutely nothing. But it was like, whoa, like I went from art director in a week of experience to all of a sudden have this big title and I'm making six figures. 4 months in, serendipity, you know, hits again. A recruiter reaches out from Microsoft, and she realizes that as we're having the conversation, she realizes like, oh, you've been there less than 6 months. I'm sorry. I normally only reach out to people who have been in their role 6 months or more. I was like, it's totally fine. Like, you can cast my resume out to different folks in the company. I don't expect to get anything back. You know, it might be some time anyway. 2 days later, she's like, okay, cool. So three teams really are interested in you. A couple weeks after that, I have phone calls with them. A couple weeks after that, I'm flying to Seattle for on-sites. And then a month after that, I'm on a plane, 30,000 feet in the air, with as much clothes as I can pack in two suitcases while the rest of it is on the back of a truck being shipped up to Seattle. And I'm having this like imposter syndrome panic attack, like, what the hell are you doing? You need to go back to Dallas. Like, these people are going to find out you're a fraud. They're going to find out that you're a faker. This is terrible. I get to Seattle. Sorry, Microsoft is great. I move across a couple teams. I realize I was hired on underleveled, which was a struggle within itself to have to fight to prove to people that I was more capable than what they thought. But I left, I started the company as a mid-level designer. I left the company almost two years later as a senior manager. And it was awesome. I had a really great reputation with the team, with the company. Went to Zillow for a year as a senior manager. I didn't realize I was promoting myself at that point. So I went from like being a senior manager at Microsoft to a senior manager at Zillow is like being a principal manager, like a step below a director. But it was crazy because in that year, I was working with my VP and with other folks. And in that year, I went from, you know, coming as a senior manager to having conversations about potentially being promoted to director. And so I did that for a year. There were some organizational shifts, and I decided I wanted to try something different again. I learned a huge amount from Zillow. And so I ended up where I am now, which is Facebook. And so if you look at my UX career or product design career, it's only really been about 3 years. And in 3 years, I went from a mid-level designer to an experienced manager in one of the biggest and probably most one of the most well-known companies in the world. So yeah, that's my, that actually isn't the short version, but that is my origin story from beginning, or at least from undergrad to now.
Well, the good news is we're not looking for short. In my experience, no path is ever simple, short, particularly as when you have decided that you're going to do audacious things.
Yeah.
I've never experienced a way to do that. Now that might exist for other people, but when you're an underrepresented voice in design, mm-hmm. I think when you love what you do, which you clearly do, that I think that the story for most of us often becomes that there is not a direct line, that we have to zig and zag. And I love your story. I'd love us just to go back for a second, because mm-hmm. I think you said something up at the top of the broadcast in that story that I think was really important, which was, I'm a gay Black man from the South.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Latinx Jew from Texas. you start in a space where your identity often formulates where that place you came from. Talk to me about, look, you are like King Kamehameha of intersectionality.
That's true.
So, very true. So I would love to dive deep into, in your youth, you talked a lot about, people identifying things about you. When did you know you were gay?
Honestly, I don't know. I think my mother knew before I did, because I remember when I first tried to come out to her, there were multiple times we had a process. But it's awesome now. But the first time I tried to come out to her, she said something to me that I didn't even know I did. She told me that she notices when, like, we go to Walmart or something like that, whenever there are men around, I seem to straighten up. My posture improved, or because we were like, but she saw like a difference in my demeanor or posture whenever men were around. I was like, and it's something I didn't know about myself. I didn't know I did. But it's also interesting that she saw that in me. Before I saw it myself. So I'll say the first time that I had a conversation about it was probably not truly until probably my late teens. But I also, I think being gay also wasn't really an option when I was younger. Like, that wasn't a thing. And I didn't actually have exposure, honestly, to other gay folks until high school, at least as far as I knew. And so, like, I think that was a, I don't know, it was just, I think I was blind to it, but also, like, I wasn't sheltered because my mother sheltered me. I was sheltered because I chose to stay home. I chose to, like, be on the computer all the time to play MMORPGs and things like that. And so the recognition of who I was really slow and late in life.
Gotcha. I always think about race as, kind of one intersection, right? We're born mm-hmm. that. And I think that we are born, whichever gender, or identity that you come away with. But absolutely. So often we don't even tap into that part of it mm-hmm. until really our teenagers, right? It's like, yeah. I was born Mexican, you were born Black. That part we knew, right?
Yeah. Well, and it's this thing of, like, how I say it is, you don't really know sometimes what you are until you have the language to define it. And so I think we run into this all the time. Like, as we learn, as we grow as human beings, we develop more and more parts of our language. And that language helps us define the thing that seemed undefinable before. And so, like, being gay, like, honestly, I've been called gay by other folks ever since I was probably in, actually from the point that I moved from North Carolina to South Carolina, like when I started elementary school, all the way through to high school almost, I'd always been, that was an insult. Like, people would call me gay. And it's so funny because they would call me and I would, like, every now and then I'll be irritated by it, but then I almost got desensitized to it. But I still, for whatever reason, I just never, at least I don't recall ever really fully applying it to myself until I was in, like, high school, until I was, like, probably in the I guess I was like 14, 15 years old, something like that. Like, you know, that's what, ninth or 10th grade. Like, that's when it really started to hit me as to like, okay, this is actually who I am. So like, I know some people who knew since they were young, and I know other folks who, like, I have a really close friend. He's in his 50s now, and he didn't actually come out or even acknowledge or even like understand that he was gay until he was in his mid 40s. Like, he had a wife, he had children, but it wasn't a part of him that he actually tapped into until he moved into his 50s or into his 40s. And that's when he actually like looked at it, explored it, dug into it, understood what it meant for him. And so like that was his journey. So I think honestly, it's just this thing of sometimes you just don't have the right language, or maybe you're not even paying attention to self enough to really understand who you are. Because I think sometimes like even self-exploration is a privilege. Like, some people are so wrapped up in having to take care of others or to like work or whatever the case may be, that they don't have the moment to sit and really absorb and reflect on self to say, who am I? What makes me me? What do I believe? Things like that.
In your community, I know certainly mine, you know, when you don't see someone that is expressing themselves or, you know, or out as gay, because to your earlier point, right? Because what was that? Like, who would you find that was out, that was, you know, it was acceptable in our communities to be Black or Mexican? Mm-hmm. You know, you throw some of the intersections on top of it and then becomes unacceptable. In some cases, may not be all cases, but in some cases, it feels unacceptable. Was there any point? Because I've always believed that at some point, even when we don't see something, therefore we don't know it, and then the ramification of that is fear. Mm. Did you ever at any time actually fear? Once you thought, well, hey, I might be gay, but I don't know what, you know, I don't know enough to know what the implications are of that.
I don't, if I had fear, it was because of like, it was fear of what would my mother think, what my family think, what would my friends say. It was fear from the perspective of like, of others. In their impression of me, like others that are close to me in their impression of me. I think that was the biggest fear. And even when I was like, so when me and my mother finally, like, there was a lot that happened in my life. When I was 17, I was the victim of rape. And so, and it was from my stepfather's older brother. And there's a whole story there in itself of like, after it happened a year later, he is high on cocaine and he beats his father to death. And so it was like this man who actually has the capability to kill someone. When I call the police and tell them about it, they were like, oh, this could just be a lover's quarrel. Like, why didn't you fight back? And I was like, because I thought he would kill me. But that crazy situation was actually a motivating factor for me and my mother to really come to terms with what was going on. And something she told me, like, that I realized, like, when she would really rage against me being gay, or she would like say like, nope, not in my house, I can't have this. When she would say certain things, it wasn't based off of hatred. It was actually based off of her own fear. And the fear that she had was what exactly happened to me. She was scared that others would hurt me for being gay. She was scared, like, she was scared of what it would mean as far as my life and what happened with it. And so, like, I think that was a moment where I had to give my mother some grace, because I for all I knew, being gay meant I would be kicked out of the house. She would never talk to me again, so on and so forth. Like, that was my fear, right? But I also had to give her grace because she had her own fear as it related to her kids and the quality of life that they would have. And she didn't want me to live with pain because of something that was innate with me.
I hear you. So in a life where you are a survivor, right? Mm-hmm. Not just a survivor of, you know, what it means to be an artist in this world, but to have survived sexual violence. What has that taught you?
You know, it's funny. So my mother was always the type that she did not allow us to stay angry. For example, let's say, like, so my mother was a whooping mother. Okay, like, you did something, you get your tail whooped. And so, like, she would do things where, for example, she would, like, let's say, for example, we got in trouble, and so we would get a whooping for it. Afterwards, like, we would, like, so I guess she would, like, have, like, a buffer moment where it's like, okay, like, you think about what you did, but then she wouldn't let us sit in that for too long. She would, like, come in, make you laugh, or, like, hey, come, let's go do something. Or, like, she had this thing of, like, I'm not going to let you sit here in pain or in anger. Like, get out of it, move past it. And so it's actually because of how she raised us, it helped me actually navigate past that. So, like, I can tell this story, like it's so funny because I think sometimes people are so much more affected by it than I am. And maybe because, like, I found a way to compartmentalize it or rationalize in a way that it helps me. But, like, that's the thing that really I walked away from is, like, I just don't have to hold this pain. Like, I just don't have to do it. I won't lie and say that I wasn't, like, I was totally scared of my uncle when we had to sit in the same van together to drive up to Pennsylvania for a family reunion because he wasn't going to get arrested. But I also saw my mother in the front seat looking back multiple times constantly as we made that drive to make sure he wouldn't even look my way. You know, like, those things, like, that fear was still there, but then over time, like, I got over it. I had my mother who, like I said, she taught us how to just release in that pain. I had a friend who was a complete asshole, and he made jokes about it, but it wasn't in an insensitive way, but it helped me take a situation that could have completely just, like, it's traumatic. It's a trauma. And they gave me mechanisms to be able to navigate my own trauma in a way that made sense for me. And so the ability to speak about trauma, the ability to talk through, like, how do you navigate it? Like, those are things I pulled from both of, like, my mother and that friend, because they taught me how to, like, release some of the pain of it, while also being able to look at it and understand, like, what happened, maybe not understand why it happened, but understand what happened to me and know that it didn't define me or wasn't, like, it wasn't a part of my story in a way that held me back from life.
So often, and, you know, in situations like that, you know, people who have, you know, who are survivors often blame themselves. Did mm-hmm. you ever find yourself making, you know, doing that, it's my fault, you know, mm-hmm. and in a place where maybe sometimes, and I have certainly found it in, you know, great designers who come from minority backgrounds, is that we tend to be harder on ourselves and blame ourselves more than any other counterpart that, like, somebody else could. Mm-hmm. Did you ever find that, you know, in those moments where something has happened to you, it becomes this traumatic part of your life, you know, to... whether it is a survivor of sexual violence, coming out to your parents. I mean, those are monumental, mm-hmm. right? And then you go and you give examples of, you know, the when, you know, someone has told you, like, you're kind of done in this space, mm-hmm. right? Good luck with that, I think was the word. But often those things end up being kind of triggering, right, in that space. And so, you know, I kind of ponder two things, and I think as we continue to talk in here, and as long as you continue to be comfortable, mm-hmm. You know, I think often we are harder on ourselves. Did you ever find that was true for you?
Well, I'll say for the situation itself, I did question myself. I was like, did I want this? One other thing that was super helpful, and I still have to this day, actually just I just shared it with my partner, is When I was an English major, creative writing was my love. So I actually wrote what happened. Like I wrote the story out, and something that I kept revisiting is the situation was like very simply, I borrowed like $5 from my uncle, and he came over to the house one summer. He was like, "Hey, so are you going to give it? Like, you know, you owe me $5." Like, yeah. And he was like, "Okay, I'll give that to you." He was like, "Well, how about you do this instead?" And so in that moment, like what he did was he left my house and he went to his house. And I was there shocked. And I remember leaving the door open, going to my room, and I didn't know what to do. And so I was like, I remember thinking to myself, should I get condoms? I don't know. It was just these thoughts were coming through my head, because I never would have expected that coming out of his mouth. And he came back over the house and he guided me over to his house. And looking back on that question, like, did I want it? Did I ask for it? Like, did I know what was happening? Should I have done this? Should I have done that? And I don't know, like it just, I did, I've even probably to this day, I still question that, but I also realized that it's one thing I gave myself grace on was like, I was in complete shock that a grown man had just started stroking himself in front of me, just started doing this, just started doing that. And so I didn't know what to do as a 17-year-old. Like I had no idea. But it was something I do question. I think looking at my career path and the things I've done in life, I would say that I don't think I've been hard on myself, but what I have done is I have learned to analyze my actions. Like I've learned to look at like, and this is something like even when it comes to people who are my leaders, like they can attest to the fact that I'm like, hey, give me feedback. Let me know what's going on. Let me know what I'm doing well. Let me know what I need growth on, because I like to analyze what I'm doing and I like to actually start to make those changes. And sometimes I get so deep into it that it stresses me out because I'm like, I need to do this. I need to figure this out. And like, I do get a hard on myself because I'm like, I have to be the best. I have to do this. I have to be X, Y, and Z. Not for someone else, because I know that I'm proving it to myself that I'm good enough, that I'm doing the right thing. And it may be a residual of imposter syndrome or something else, but it's a thing where sometimes I do a root cause analysis on myself, which it doesn't sound as technical. Like I don't do it as technically as it sounds, but in my head, like I go through scenarios, I rethink things, I look at my actions, I consider it, I think through how can I do this better all the time. Like it's a constant thing. And the thing at least I try to do is make sure that I'm not crippled by it. I leverage that to drive me to action versus sitting in the corner like, oh, I should have done, I would have done, I wish I could have done. And that's the biggest thing. Like that's the thing I care about the most is like, am I consistently biasing towards action, even when I'm being hard on myself, even when I'm questioning, did I do the right thing, whatever the case may be.
I think that ends up being a really remarkable way of growth. Mm-hmm. It certainly sounds like it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's helped me a lot because it's given me a level of self-awareness that that I feel like I haven't seen a lot in a lot of people. And it's like a blessing and a curse.
I hear you. So, you know, you seem, again, we go from, you know, in art direction, through the metamorphosis of I'm going to go into retail and try that for a bit, right? Mm-hmm. And then into design. Were you always a problem solver in every single one of those situations?
Oh, yeah. Here's the interesting thing is that two things I've been more than anything else is I've been a leader most of my career, like a leader/manager. With that comes so many things. When I was an undergrad, I was directing a choir. And on top of that, I was working in, like I said, the Office of Student Leadership, and I was a manager there. And so that means that I was constantly having to solve not only problems, but as it related to the organization, I also had to like be the mentor. I had to be the big brother. I had to be the mediator and all these other things. And so things like process and like all those things I've had to do, like probably for, yeah, since probably even before undergrad, that's just always been my thing. And so solving problems, coordinating people, mentoring, growing folks, getting feedback, like all those things have been deeply ingrained into every role I've had. Like even for example, like when I was a store manager, I was store manager at Things Remembered in Charlotte. And it was, I like to tell people, like I was still in design because there was an engraving shop. And so someone, like I was the only person in the entire district for Charlotte who knew how to do things like engrave wood or engrave like really unique and like nuanced pieces of, you know, or trinkets. And so, but that came because I like would sit there and I would assess the item. I would understand what's going on. I would like play around with different ways to do it. And then I would just execute. And I think like, if nothing else, that time in retail, my God, if that doesn't teach you how to solve problems when you have, it's Valentine's Day and you have a pissed off customer in front of you because you just misengraved their locket, the Kate Spade locket. And so you have to go and figure out how to get another one and how to replace it to make sure they have a gift for Valentine's Day. Like if you can't go through that, then God, that would teach you a lot about how to problem solve and manage tough situations.
Gotcha. So I'd love to kind of dive deep into the work, right? You know, whether mm-hmm. it was when you were an art director, even at retail, I always found no matter, you know, what part of the industry, I looked at it and said, you know, I started in a world of like technology consulting. Actually, I started out as a journalist. Then, you know, I stumble into technology consulting because that's who needed a video solution at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, I had this interesting thing, but I always found that it was in those moments that I was still doing the same behaviors. You know, I went, well, actually, I'm really an inventor, right? A part of being a designer is leading through in inventing, whether that's a new type font, whether it was, you know, a video player that streamed, whether that was inventing messaging for a brand or a campaign. I think that we are, you know, as makers, we are inventive and innovative. In that, with that vein, what would you say are some of your favorite inventions or creations?
I would start with the thing that was my first love, which is writing. The stories and poems that I created as a writer, as a creative writer, are among my favorite because they taught me how to express myself and they helped me communicate emotionally in a way that it was really tough for me to communicate emotionally in other ways. I think beyond that, honestly, and this is something that's happened over the past few years actually, is being able to take the ability to take what we do in human-centered design and recode it and apply it to organizational culture and diversity, equity, inclusion work. Like that to me is my favorite because I'm being able, like I'm coming at it from a lens that is outside of this very 1960s driven HR framework that has not changed. And saying like, how do we actually affect change on this designed entity? And how do we use things like human-centered design principles and social justice principles and racial equity principles to really address and drive forward organizational culture, systemic change, things like that. And I think to me, that is a thing that really gets me going even more than like design work. Like I love product design. I love solving problems for folks. Like I love just digging deep into these different nuanced cases and saying like, how do we make this better? How do we improve it? How do we do something new? because the impact on people and on humans is so much more palpable. And like, it's a level of instant gratification to see how you can take design concepts and apply them to an organization to improve the lives of multiple types of people across multiple intersections. And to me, like, while I didn't create human-centered design and didn't create the application per se of bringing it to organizational culture, the connections I've made in that on my own, just like working, like talking to friends who are in these different spaces of social justice and racial equity, and then taking the framework of design and bringing those all together into something that's interesting and something that actually affects real strategic and palpable and tangible change. That's just like, that is a tapestry that is so beautiful to me that it just really gets me going every time I think about it, every time I engage in it.
That's fabulous. So give me an example of when you've done that, or, you know, let's get specific. I love to point to people's, the things that you've made, and you go, damn, I'm really proud of that.
Yeah. I'll say one, just right off the bat, and it's probably the most recent, like just a year ago, is when I was at Zillow, when I joined, I was the only Black person to have ever been on that design team, both in general and as a leader. When I left, we had taken that and we had increased the number. I want to say it was like 30% or something like that, but we had created one of the most diverse design and research teams, I think, in the industry. From that perspective, like, folks of color, let's say Black women especially, made up a large chunk. They made up a huge chunk of designers on the team. Latinx in general, like those folks, like the research team was actually very, had a lot of Latinx folks on it. And not only that, but there were Latinx folks with PhDs. Like just the frameworks we worked on with recruiting to the challenge, what should we be looking for as we talk about, like, what's a good candidate? How do we apply a more broad or a better, a broader definition to what we need in the organization to ensure that we're more inclusive in how we hire and how we recruit. The fact that we did the work to work with recruiting to get them really trained up on what is it we're looking for in a designer first, like look at their work, not their resume. Let's see if they have the work, the caliber of work first. And if they have that, then let's bring them in and have a conversation and let's gauge them on that and their potential versus on, oh, they work for this place for 2 years and this other place for a year and a half. Because there are a lot of people who were hired who never worked in UX before, or they only had a certain kind of career and they joined the company and they are rock stars. And so for me, that is a really good example, like a microcosm of where we took organizational culture, we took are these precepts of how we even think about what is the bar, how do we think about the skills assessment of our team, things like that. And we applied it in reality and quickly to not only grow our team, like almost doubling it, but we grew it in a thoughtful way where diversity, equity, inclusion was deeply ingrained into every decision we made. And we never, you know, that tech saying of lowering the bar, like we never had to consider that because everybody hit that bar and we brought them in from so many different locations across the country. So that's something to me that I'm super proud of because that is a tangible impact that I had working with the other team, with the other leaders, working with the recruiting, chatting and working with the VP of recruiting, working with at the previous, was that VP of culture and or equity and belonging, like the work that I did with them to just drive that impact was to me really something to be proud of.
Fantastic. You know, I put, just to let you know, I put myself on mute so that when we do the audio cut, you only hear you and it's not me in the background. So a lot of times I'm like back here reacting. And I'm like, man, that's deep. Taking notes. I didn't want you to think you're alone on this one.
No, it's cool.
Okay. So, you know, that gives me the idea around, you know, that you have really created an impact, and it seems to have had an enormous payoff in the community. And that diversity in design is something really important to you. What have you learned about that problem space?
I learned a few things. And this year, one of the biggest things, I'll start most recent, one of the biggest things I learned was this year, it's not really a learning, but really a refocusing. So myself, Antoinette Carroll, and Timothy Hikes, we've been working together, at least I've been working with them. They were the co-founders of Design Plus Diversity Conference, and I've been working with them for the past few years on Design Plus Diversity. And I'd also co-founded the Design Plus Diversity Fellowship with Antoinette Carroll. And, you know, something, we made a few decisions this year on how we wanted to pivot. And Antoinette and I actually, we realized that, you know, working with Tim, we realized that one thing we wanted to do was actually create a bit of a separation. So like Tim can drive Diversity Design Plus Diversity Conference and he can continue that vision moving forward. But Antoinette and I really wanted to focus in on equity and design. Because I think that's the thing is, I've been so passionate about this, like diversity in design, and we know like those numbers for like people of color in general, well, people of color in general, but specifically for Black, Latinx and Indigenous folks in design is extremely low. Like, you know, it's maybe 3%. And I think that number hasn't changed in the past 5 years or more. And so knowing that, we also realized that the problem we're seeing is actually an equitable problem. It's equity. It's okay, this person doesn't have, like a great example is, you know, previously there was a candidate who was getting interviewed for a role, and I won't say what company, but they were getting interviewed for a role and they had higher decisions across the board, but they chose to pass on this candidate who happened to be a Black person for one reason only, because the person did not actually quote unquote ship their work. So they were amazing. They hit all these check marks. Yes, is a great person. But the fact is that a reason it could be completely not their fault. It could be because of organizational shifts or anything. Because they didn't actually get their work out in the world, they didn't ship, they did not get the job. That is a huge problem. And I question, if she were a white man, would that have happened? If she were a white woman, would that have happened? Or especially in tech, which is majority white man, of course, but also of folks of Asian descent. Like, I just wonder if you look at the folks who are considered the majority within certain spaces, would that have happened? And is that equitable? And so that's something that I'm digging more and more on. And I've been like, even in, you know, I work very closely with leadership for Facebook app for diversity and inclusion. And one thing I've pushed on is like, can we add equity into the name? Can we make sure that's there? Because when equity is not intentionally put in something, it can also be unintentionally ignored. And so I think that's the thing for me is in design, are we being equitable? Equitable being, are we hiring people because of their skills and because of what they can potentially bring to the table, not because of just what they have quote unquote done, or because they went to a specific school or because they live in a specific area. Equity means also when we're creating, how are we understanding the populations that we create for? Like, we are designers. It is our moral obligation to understand the people who we design for, their cultural context, and ensure that we're not breaking those and we're being considerate of those human beings. And so, like, to me, there's like the twofold side of equity. And for the folks who are designers who are getting into the industry, and how can we improve on getting diversity into the industry in an equitable way, then we know that that starts all the way back in sometimes elementary school. And so what are the things we can do from elementary school all the way up through college and beyond college not only to get people understanding what design is, but understand it's a viable field and understand that they have ways, pathways to leadership and growth. If they, not if they play the game, but if we change the industry and we change the way we actually work. And so that's really something that has been super important for me, especially as of late. And it's something that where it was important, let's say, intrinsically in the work that I was doing before, now it is the core, like it is the thing that we say explicitly, equity, equity, equity.
I often think about equity in a couple places too, and I think it's important for us to probably let's explore this area. Because mm-hmm. equity means to me, and I talk a lot about this in Equal Pay Day, things like that, right, is mm-hmm. we all don't start from the same place.
Right.
There isn't an equal playing field.
Right.
And so when we think about equity, and I think about diversity and equity, when you don't start from the same place, mm-hmm. how do you ensure in the hiring process that we make the necessary adjustments so that we do start in the same place?
Mm.
Like, we always talk about meeting people where they're at, mm-hmm. right? But those of us Latinx, right, in the Black mm-hmm. community, you just take like Equal Pay Day. I did this, you know, it's like our Equal Pay Day when it comes to, you know, women in design is different than the Black Equal to Pay Day, right? You can go yeah. down and say on different parts of the calendar, we are starting from a totally different spot.
Right.
Have you ever given some thought around how do we course correct that, particularly in the interview process where you get there? And you have all the mechanisms in the hiring process, but yet you're trying to create the even playing field. What do we need to do for our communities of color and our underrepresented voices to get them that equity in the hiring process?
Honestly, sometimes, and this isn't the panacea for everything, but I think sometimes one of the most important places we can potentially start is having representation in the interview process. And I say it's not the panacea because the best way I can put it is even people of color can exhibit white supremacist culture, right? It is the and it happens all the time. Like we all can be guilty of it in some way, and there are deep and broad, there are clear representations or definitions of what white supremacist culture is. But just to say, we can exhibit those same fallacies as a white man or as any other kind of, you know, majority-like persona. But that said, I do believe that having first representation in the process is important because. Like it may be something that's culturally relevant or something that's culturally nuanced that other folks won't pick up, that someone who may hopefully be of the same culture or at least of a underinvested group may see and understand and be able to advocate for, right? I think the second thing is what I've seen some companies do it, some don't, but like there should always be like a safety net for those people in the sense that if for some reason that we have a really strong candidate that comes through and like, let's go back to the example of the Black woman who did everything right, but still got a no because she didn't ship anything. There should be a mechanism in place for someone to look back and to say, wait, we need to review this again. Like there should be a catch to that so that someone can go back and say, let's review this and let's actually take a second look at this because there must be something wrong. I think that's super important. I think that things like, especially for let's say product design, having things like what are the, do the interviewees or the interviewers know some of the, let's say adjacent definitions of some of the words they're talking about. So maybe this person doesn't have the term or A/B testing in their toolbox, But the thing that they're talking about is actually really close or relevant to A/B testing. It's just this thing of how we expand our minds to better understand what is the place that the person is coming from versus expecting them to come in and speak our exact language. And if they don't speak our language, then obviously they are not qualified. I think just those small things are ways that can help. I don't think there's any way to remove bias from interview processes. I don't think there's any way to really make them truly equitable outside of having those gates, having those, that representation, just trying to do the right thing. But the meat of it is how do you change human nature? And especially nature that has been so ingrained with, or culture that has been so ingrained with, this is what it looks like. This is what success looks like. This is what so on and so forth looks like. Like, that's not something that we can train out of people. That's not something that just goes away overnight. It honestly takes very conscious allies and then representation in clear and respected representation to be able to actually help make some of those changes.
That's a fabulous answer. That's a fabulous answer. So let's talk about some of the things that I think that you've really highlighted, right? Which are, the areas of passion that you've got, right? Both individually is your identity, but I think even more so broadly is in our profession as designers and what we need to do. I think we all have a journey. Yeah. During your journey, who are the people who have sponsored your success?
I would say, actually, it's funny, I have a fairly short list. I'll always and forever call out my mother because sometimes for me, it wasn't like, what she did for me many times was just allow me to be. And then as she saw me grow and develop, she basically provided that encouragement of, you got this, go do it. And while that's not sponsorship, that is something that I believe I need in life, just to be like, to have someone to say, you got it. Like, you've done it before, keep doing it. So I think that's probably one of the most important people, of course. As I mentioned, Miss Diane, when I was an undergrad, they sponsored my success. They took a chance on me. They saw my potential, and I would not be a designer if it wasn't for them, period. That choice to make the transition, the choice to change my major, those are in direct correlation to them, and I'll always be indebted to them and ever grateful for them. And then beyond that, a good friend of mine who actually I mentioned, he's the one who came out later in life. He's the person who allowed me to work with him. He basically is like, my company needs a new website and logo, help me out. And then he allowed me to continuously do work with him and his company as I was in retail, to be able to continue, like, to build up my portfolio, to have a story to tell so that I can get to my next place. Like, if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have gotten the jobs that I got to move forward. A lot of the work I did was like just me taking leaps of faith on my own. But I will say that, someone who I'll name one other person. In his own interesting and unique way, Peter Skillman sponsored me, and he helped me, him and Jay Cook, who were both my leaders at Microsoft. When I was deciding to leave Microsoft, they're the ones who said, what can we do to keep you here? And they went to bat to get me the promotion, get me moved to management, to give me a bigger space and more responsibility, things things like that. And so I'll acknowledge that too, because, you know, they could have easily said, okay, cool, bye. And I don't know where I would be right now. Like, I could be in a totally different place. And finally, most recently, within Zillow was Jeremy Jobling. He was my VP at Zillow. He actually just came over to Facebook on a different team, but in the same org. So I'm super excited about that. And he was great because, you know, he's a guy with a visual impairment. We had a conversation once around, like, he's like, yeah, I'm blind, you're black. Like, there's some things we both are going through. but he's like, he's awesome. And he was a great sponsor and a great leader. And he's someone who told me, like, I pick at him all the time. Like, he sort of gave me a swift kick in the ass one day. He was like, you know, stop telling us what's the right thing to do. Just go do it. Just like, go do it. And when we did it, it was like one of the first times as a leader, I was like, man, like, I can buy, like, I still need to buy a source action. I need to teach my team to do the same way. I need to do this and do that. But he also stood up for me. He also advocated for me with leadership. He also was the one who was making space for me to move into that director level role while at Zillow, to say, hey, here's the opportunity. Here's what I'm thinking. How would you form this organization? And he gave me the opportunity to form it the way that made sense for me. And so, you know, when he left the company, that was really tough on me, because he was someone who I saw myself in from a personality perspective. You know, he's like this 6 foot something tall white dude. But I saw a lot of our same personality traits. But also, he said to me, he was like, you know what, I like the R101s, it was a lot of times was, I'm talking to you about this stuff because I don't want you to make the same mistakes I did coming up as a designer. But we also had really good conversations where, like, I talked to him about white supremacist culture. I explained what it meant. And I showed him how, like, many times how that culture permeated even in the organization itself to us as designers versus our relationship with product teams. You know, he and I had a lot of great conversations just around different things, like him, a person with disabilities. He never wanted to, like, use his visual impairment as an excuse for anything. But we had a great conversation around the fact that, hey, you know, especially with women, if, because he was having a tough time many times with his female employees, it was like, with women, maybe they, it's possible they use more bodily and non-verbal language. And so because of that, maybe it's worth you saying, hey, just so you know, I can't see a lot of the nonverbal language you may be doing, whether it's like a change in face or posture. So could you let me know if I'm talking too much or if I'm doing too much so that I can pull back? And those are really great conversations he and I had. And so he was a really great mentor and sponsor in that way. And I think that was a really important thing, is he didn't just go to bat for me. He actually helped me develop as a person as he went to bat for me.
Those are great examples. What inspires you?
Oh, God, just being black every day. honestly, I just, the things that inspire me are, honestly, just like, it sounds so cliche, but just like people, like, my team at Facebook is awesome. My team at Zillow is awesome. My team at Microsoft was awesome. Like, being a leader and watching your team grow and develop is probably one of the most awesome experiences a leader can have if you're a good leader.
Thank you so much for joining me on this journey today. I invite you to join us on the next episode as we discover the voices and magic makers changing the very shape of our future by design.